Jordan trying to shake off Starks. Oh, what a move!
LeBron James with no regard for human life. Final seconds. Bryant for the win.
Bang! Iverson against Gill, the crowd on its feet. Allen for the win.
Welcome to the Sneaker History Podcast.
What is good, everybody? Welcome back to the Sneaker History Podcast. Nick Engvall here. I've got a special conversation for you today. As most of you know, I've kind of been diving pretty deep into the Substack world over the past 3 or 4 months. One of my favorite follows subscriptions over there is something you might relate to, because I know I have a love-hate relationship with the sport of running. And Running Sucks on Substack is written by Razik Roof. Has a book coming out, and I just was able to, he sent me the book, and I wanted to talk to him about it because he has some really interesting stuff about the kind of super shoes, if you will. And I know we've had lots of conversations in the Discord about that. We've had lots of conversations on the podcast about that over the past handful of years. But I figured, let's get somebody who knows deeply about the running aspect of what these shoes do. But before we get to that, there's a lot more questions I have for you about this book, but let's have you introduce yourself to the audience, and we'll get into some of the talking points.
Hi there. I'm Raz. I live in LA. This is not a Californian accent, though. You probably could have figured that out. Born and raised in London. I've been running and writing for my whole adult life, and I'm very happy to be here on Sneaker History.
Yeah, good to chat with you, man. Congratulations on the book, first and foremost.
Thanks so much.
That's a big deal. And, you know, I think it's something that it kind of seems like it might go, I was going to try to make a foot and foot joke, but it's kind of like hand in hand with running, right? It's the tangible aspects of life that we're all kind of craving right now. So I think there's a good convergence for you with this book and what you do. But specifically, you kind of hooked me with the book. As I said, I haven't gotten through the whole thing yet. I'm about halfway through, but the radical act of running, I think, is what you called it. And that was kind of like, it resonated with me in a way that I didn't really think flipping it open was going to, you know, I wasn't expecting that to be the positioning. So maybe give a little context there for people, because I think that's a really powerful narrative to start off with.
I mean, spoiler alert, that is the first sentence in the book. It is like every time I go for a run, it changes me in some way, you know? Just on a base level, you think about calories in, calories out. Okay, I've maybe lost an ounce of fat or something like that, or just sweat, you know. But you're a different person when you come back. When you're looking around, if you're running outside, you know, you're like noticing different things on your run, and you get a different perspective through that, or you get to inflict your perspective on the things that you see. Either way, like, you're doing something different, and you're doing something. You're really doing something. So I think running is one of the most human things that we can do. And it's one of the most human things that we can do to ourselves as well.
Yeah. And I think what was really interesting about the way you position this, that, you know, admittedly, I would even say that when you said you were sending it to me, I expected more, I don't know why, but I expected more like training-esque. Like that, I think, is just the kind of stereotype of running books and culture. And you really kind of look at this in a much different perspective than I think I've experienced, you know. And maybe that's the nature of working in the sneaker business for 20-plus years and having very much a performance, everything is tracked, analytical perspective on if a shoe functions, or if you know, all those things. So talk a little bit about that, because I think that's something that, you know, people are, I mean, I don't think you can be on the internet or in a neighborhood without seeing this massive, you know, kind of boom of running that we're having right now. Like
100%
everywhere you look, there's really unique perspectives and ways to get into it. And you kind of bring a lot of those, outliers of this whole, what I would say is the one big running culture, into this conversation in a really unique way.
Yeah, that's nice to hear. Thanks. From my perspective, I'm a magazine journalist, you know, by trade, I guess. And I kind of looked at putting this together as a big special edition magazine, you know, one of those ones that costs $15 on the newsstand. And it's like that, but more. It's like a book version of that. So, you know, there are loads of great photos in there as well. My words are my words. They're as good as they're going to get. But I just thought, how can I augment this? How can I make this a really amazing thing for somebody to pick up and read and then want to own as well? Because, you know, I love the library. Go get it from the library. But if you want to buy a copy, I think it'll add to, you know, your home. It'll add to your book. It'll add to your bookshelf. It'll look great on your coffee table as well. So I thought about this book very holistically, thought about the total package. But in terms of expecting it to be more of a guidebook, I'm a trained marathon endurance running coach, and I have those books, and they are boring as hell. You can get all that shit on the internet. You can find your training plans. Sure, it's good to get, if you're really gunning for a marathon or a race, whatever that race is, and you want to get fast and whatnot, go get a coach. Sure, you can get, there are plenty of books out there that will help you train. You know, they've got training plans in, like, printed in the middle and stuff like that, or they come with a wall chart. So I don't need to do that. I'm not going to do that any better than the top coaches have already done, but I can do this better than anyone else can do. So that was my goal, to do it a bit differently and to do it in my way.
Yeah, I love that, man. And even just like, I don't give too much away on the book, but even just some of the pictures that you chose to start the book.
Yeah.
The first, you know, 10, 20 pages are really powerful.
Yeah.
And for context for our listeners, you know, as I said, I've had a love-hate relationship with running.
Same.
Tweaked my back a couple of years ago and kind of fell off the wagon for the last 2.5 years. And between then and, you know, 10, 15 years prior, I would go in, you know, bursts of, I'm really into this for months, sometimes years at a time.
Yeah.
And some of the most fun that I had with it was the most casual aspect of running. You know, it's the, for me, it was the Beta Breakers in San Francisco, where it's, you know, I did that 4 years, four or five years. And it's just the chaos of everyone being a part of it.
Yeah.
And I think even in like your introduction, you kind of bring a lot of those things that people might not realize are running culture.
Yeah.
You know, like we have this like kind of vision of what it is, and then there's like the reality. And I think what I was really excited when, you know, we connected was to talk to you about that, in a sense that I think the sneakerhead audience has very much a similar perspective on the culture of sneakers. You know, like there's obviously a consumer aspect to all of this that's, you know, forced down everybody's throat. And, you know, then there's like the, you know, hundreds of friends that I've made over the years that I've never even talked, you know, I've never said, hey, what are you wearing today? Kind of, you know, like that, just that, but that's what people think when they think of sneakerheads or sneaker enthusiasts.
Oh, totally.
So like, I guess like how this is kind of a two-part question. How do you go about choosing, you know, the stories based on, are they based on your experience? What kind of research did you do to get into this? Obviously being a part of it, you know, you're probably like me on the sneaker side. I have mental notes of 20 years of like, one day this is going. And then I think maybe even kind of, you could lead into the next question that I have is really about like being in LA where, you know, you're in probably the most car centric city on the planet.
Yeah.
but also one of the most beautiful places to run. You know, I lived mm-hmm. in Santa Monica for years, lived in West Hollywood for years. I mean, you know, might not be the best for as far as smog goes, but it's sure. absolutely one of my favorite places to run. So
100%.
So talk a little bit about that.
I think it's exactly that. You know, I started, you know, I ran when I was, I ran track at school, you know, high school athletics team. So I come from like the old school, I guess, in that regard. You know, that was some years ago, let's say. But then since that, you know, I started running again as an adult in about 20 years ago now. And so I've seen like the full spectrum of stuff of the running world growing, you know, everything from, world records being broken in the London Marathon to, you know, Linford Christie running in the Olympics in the 90s, to moving to LA and running with run crews here, and like as a way of discovering both the city and like a prospective new friends group. So yeah, a lot of it is through experience. It is, but also like that curiosity, I think, is something that I see in a lot of people who have a podcast and have maintained a podcast for a long time. There's this curiosity where a desire to understand the world, understand themselves through the world. So yeah, a lot of my perspectives are in this book in terms of the subject matter, that the stuff that I've chosen. Like, I'm sure there's some stuff that I've missed out. I've tried to be as comprehensive as I can, of course, but it's impossible to put everything into one book. But I'm pretty happy with it so far. But yeah, like, I mean, but going back to sneakers, what you were saying about sneaker culture, well, when I found out that Stan Smith was a tennis player, I was like, oh, no shit. Okay. I love these shoes just as walking around shoes. And then like finding out friends who've got they're pure Nike heads, Nike only, nothing else. And that's kind of the same way that I interact with comic books. I love Batman. There are people who I found out are just pure Nike sneaker heads. And I kind of love the focus of it, because when it comes to collecting comic books, I'm pure Batman. You know, people ask me about Justice League and I'm like, no, dude, I'm Batman only. Like, I love that you love that stuff, but I only care about Batman. And so, yeah, like everyone interacts with their thing in their very specific way. And it can be difficult to even consider that there's another way. But that's kind of what this book is for. Like, if you are someone who only runs with crews, find out about the other stuff. If you are somebody who only wears, you know, the classic old school clothes, here's all this new stuff. Or if you only go to this new wave of running store, how about these? This is the old school. This is how it used to be. So I want this book to be something that people can discover the other sides of running, because there are so many other sides of running.
Yeah. So you kind of mentioned a little bit about it and your experience moving to LA and mm-hmm. kind of using running and connecting with crews to, you know, kind of expand your network and friends and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And that seems to be like something that is, it feels cyclical to me, but it feels like we're on the highest of peaks that we've seen in a really long time with it because there are so many ways. And I think I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that, like, you know, there's probably a third of our listeners that are active runners.
Sure.
And a majority of our listeners are probably either in and out or just have no interest. Mm-hmm. How do you look at that in terms of, like, you know, its impact on running as a whole?
Yeah.
But what would you suggest for, you know, kind of the new person that, you know, it feels, maybe it feels intimidating because, like you said, they mm-hmm. see somebody who's got all the gear and
yeah.
you know, see them out there every day. And it's like, hey, I just want to go out and run. Mm-hmm. What would you suggest for that type of, you know, new to running person?
Keep trying. Don't get discouraged. Cause like I said, there are so many different ways in which you can engage with it. You know, if you are brand new to running, the chances are you'll feel like you're too slow, or you'll worry that you're too slow to join a crew. But the reality of it is, once you find the right crew, they'll just run with you, you know? And they won't give a shit, because the run crews that are truly social, they're all about true inclusivity and bringing more people into the sport. Because all I want is for more people to run, because I love it and I want everyone else to love it. And you know, I do this with my crew. I lead a Tuesday morning, 7 a.m. Just from the bottom of my street, and people message me on Instagram saying, "Oh, I'm too slow. Like, I want to come, but I'm worried I'm too slow." It's like, I'll run with you. It's okay. You know, on the one hand, that's kind of what being a good leader is, right? Making sure that everybody's supported. That's not the case for every crew. And so if you do go to one and you feel like you're being left behind, keep trying, find another one, and you'll find your people.
Yeah, man, I love that. I know people are listening to this thinking, man, you've got like the same perspective on running that I have on like sneaker,
yeah,
kind of, you know, the enthusiasm for sneakers, because it's such a powerful, for me, sneakers is such a powerful tool for connecting with people.
Yes.
And talking to people and learning about different backgrounds. You know, mm-hmm. You meet people from all walks of life, and yet all of us can have either that Stan Smith story or the Converse Chuck Taylor story, mm-hmm. or the Air Jordan story. And it's like, all of a sudden, we're from different parts of the world, but then all of a sudden we're not anything more than, you know, two people kind of having a conversation about something that we absolutely are passionate about. So it's cool to hear you say that, because I think that's, you know, part of a lot of, you know, and as you said, leadership, right? Like, I feel like there's a lack of that in a lot of places in the world too, because we're, you see it, and I don't want to get too deep into this, but I see it even in the running kind of runner's world aspect of things, where there's like people going back and forth, there's kind of cattiness and just like negativity around it. And it's always going to be there. Yeah. But I'm very much one of those people that's just like, let's just keep it moving.
Yeah.
And that'll iron itself out on the side. Yeah, and people will come back in once they're done with their little things. So,
yeah.
It's cool to hear. Cause I, as like a, you know, I don't want to say outsider, but as somebody who hasn't been running in the last couple of years, I'm not in the same circle of friends that I'm keeping in touch with either. Mm-hmm. Which is a really interesting aspect of, you know, for me, cause like, I think you even mentioned this in the book some, or maybe I'm just filling in the gaps here in my mind, but
I like
you
that.
Talk about COVID a little bit and like that loneliness that we're all kind of coming off of. And, I recently talked to a guy named Pete Forrester, who's done a lot of content, a lot of storytelling, interviews, writing for a lot of these brands throughout the years. And one of the things that he said to me that stuck, that I'm kind of thinking about from a different perspective after starting to read your book, is, you know, we never really healed from COVID. We never really had like a true end.
Yes.
And most things that we experience, you know, in life that are that traumatic have a very like, okay, we're going to say we're done with this and then we're going to move forward. So it is something I think, you know, that people are still finding their ways to it. And I think, you know, that probably helps in the growth of running in this kind of era.
I mean, the pandemic was instrumental in the rise of running. You know, I think in the UK especially, the UK had pretty strict lockdowns. Like, we didn't really have any lockdowns in the US. Everyone was just kind of, you know, we were asked to stay indoors, but, you know, not everyone did. In the UK, there were genuine sanctions on people who were found to be breaking the laws and stuff like that. And but they were also given a government mandated hour a day to go exercise outdoors, to go, you know, like a prison yard. Here's your hour of yard time. And running was one of the biggest, most like easiest ways of doing that, because you didn't need any gear apart from a pair of shoes, you know. Cycling was a great one for people who had a bike, but for, you know, in the UK where a lot of people live in small houses or apartments, you know, storing a bike is impossible. Like swimming pools are off limits as well. Like of the three big cardio activities, running was by far and away the easiest. And then once those limitations were lifted and people were allowed to mingle again, the run clubs just went like wildfire. Because as soon as people were able to get together again, you know, they still might not have been able to go to work or go to the bars and restaurants and stuff like that. But once they were able to get together for exercise, something healthy, they were saying, oh, I like running. You like running as well? Let's make a run club. Let's get more people that like running together. And so run clubs, run crews, they went like wildfire. And and they're such great communities. You know, I write about how running in a group feels, and the things that you go through when you're running, when you're pushing your body, are very intimate things, you know?
Yeah.
Happiness, pain, puking, laughing, crying, all of these things like really help to make social bonds quickly and strong. And so like run clubs are amazing for those two things. So yes, a great byproduct of COVID was these run clubs. And yeah, we're arguably still in a pandemic, so you know, there is that.
Yep. Yeah, the run club thing is really interesting too, because it's, you know, like anything that becomes, you know, whatever that tipping point of popularity is, once it hits a certain threshold, then you get kind of like, you get like the, you know, the people like you who are just going to say, hey, meet me at the bottom of the hill. This is where we're going to go. This is what we're going to do. And then you get kind of this influx of brands that are trying to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, obviously we'll get to the sneaker conversation, but I'm kind of curious what you think and how you view, you know, like the brand run clubs now. Like, I have a love-hate relationship with those just because I've seen so many people get put on a project, whether that's running or whatever other caveat popular thing that happens, you know, that not to pick on Nike or Adidas, but if Nike or Adidas says, hey, this is cool now, let's put a team on this, and then it disappears, you know, figure out what they do with their lives and how they pick it up and keep it moving. So I wonder how you feel about that in regards to, you know, kind of the community aspect of running. I guess my question for you is, how do you view those kind of, you know, bigger entities coming into the space? Because obviously there's part of it where, you know, you want the money and the energy that they bring, but it also comes with, you know, a loss of like real connection for a lot of people because there's just more hands in the pot, let's say.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. It's, some things are compromised. It's not a pure community anymore. That's kind of it. On the one hand, these people that put in so much time and effort into organizing these huge, you know, some have 4 weekly events, you know, and they deserve to get paid for that time. They deserve to have some reward. Yeah. And also the brands coming in can help pay for some extra stuff, you know, like paying to hire a high school track out. So then that brand money, that brand that has billions of dollars, some of that money is funneled into the real community. Like they give money to a school, so the school gets to upgrade their facilities. And this run community, this organically created run community, has a new facility to train at. You know, that's kind of the big picture thinking of why it's good. But then there are always compromises. You know, a lot of times the crews are not friends, you know, they're very territorial and they kind of shit on each other from, you know, behind each other's back and stuff like that. But then, oh, look, they're sponsored by the same brand and they have to collaborate. And there's this awkward tension because one of them's organized an event and the other one has to attend it contractually. And, going back to that purity of community, that's not pure community, is it? That's paid for community. And if it sells shoes, then cool. People need shoes. They do. but there are better ways of finding the next best pair of shoes, I think.
Yeah, totally agree. It's a it's a really interesting aspect of kind of all things, you know, adjacent. It's not even just sneakers, but since we talk about sneakers on this show, but it's just an interesting capitalistic consumerism conversation that you know, could probably go a lot deeper on. But speaking of the shoes, you know, like you have a really great chapter on this, you know, kind of super shoe movement, I guess, over the last, you know, five-ish years, maybe even a bit
more than that. 2000,
probably 10 years now. Yeah.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah. The pandemic also has my ability to remember what time, you know, it feels like it was 6 months ago, but also 20 years ago at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I want to say that it was 2017 that the shoe, I'm going to just check my notes being my book.
Link in the description if you need to get it. Right?
2016. Yeah, I guess it was the Olympics 2016. Of course it was. That's right. Yep. There is. I don't even know either. but yeah, the super shoe, the carbon plated running shoe, changed running completely. So yeah, almost 10 years since that. And it changed how people run completely. Everything from the mechanics, the physical human biomechanics of how people run. You know, you see some of these elite marathoners and they have this strange gait. They're like clomping because the carbon plate is there in the midsole. And so you need to push down. The flatter you can push down on it, the better the spring will be. And so if you adjust how you hit the ground, you can get a better bounce and better economy. And so you'll use less energy and you'll be able to run harder for longer. It's all of these little things. And, you know, it changed coaching because now the best coaches might be the one that understand that the best and can advise their athletes on how to run. But then, you know, there are other things like, you know, there's talk about only using it for races because it's pretty hard on your body, hard on your Achilles and whatnot.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's changed the whole of that little portion of running marathons really, really fast. It's changed that. It's put it on its head and made new things possible.
Yeah. It's such an interesting, you know, kind of it just went so wide, so quickly, you know, over, you know, I feel like it was a 2-year window where it was like, you know, every brand had their variation of that plate technology, which is funny to me because I go back to like, you know, like the Pump Fury, you know, like being a, I mean, it has the same, not the same, obviously, but it was this close to being that in the early 90s, you know, mid 90s. And it's kind of just interesting how it all kind of, you know, like blew up into this new, like even the conversations when it happened in 2016, 2017 of like, you know, is this going to be regulated? How much is this going to be regulated?
Yeah, yeah.
All of these kind of conversations that hadn't really bubbled up into the mainstream in quite some time, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. But then, one thing I want to ask you about that is I was just talking to a friend about this over the last few days. And so I was recently kind of went up to San Francisco to go to the Museum of Modern Art up there. And my girlfriend is wearing, I forget the model, but I want to say they're like Adidas, maybe like an Adizero Boston. Like it's a pretty chunky, you know, definitely a performance runner, but probably a handful of years old, but she loves the look of it. And like, it's fairly comfortable, but this day we spent the whole day walking around the city. So it was definitely much more wear and tear on her than she is used to. And she's kind of like, wow, I didn't realize how uncomfortable these would be over the course of a whole day.
Interesting.
And then I was talking to another friend after that about the idea of, you know, when you walk into, like, I walked into the Nike store and you can kind of see, like, these are the, you know, like the super shoes. This is where you're at for running. and then there's everything else, right? It feels very intentional. They're going to keep the alpha fly and that, like, very, you know, and rightfully so, right? Like, they know that their target audience wants a certain level. They're going to spend much more on those shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? There's a lot of expensive shoes in there right now, but but then the conversation that I had after that was, do you think that the general consumer, one, understands, like, the, you know, how hard that can be on your body?
Sure.
The casual aspect of it is really interesting, because over the past 2 or 3 years, you've seen shoes like the Alpha Fly at Fashion Week and, like, as a part of these much bigger campaigns, which I love those connections, but I also kind of feel like those shoes don't feel like they fit to me. And, you know, like, it's really the first time I feel like we've had, like, pure performance in a running shoe form, you know, be so popular.
Yeah.
But then I wonder if
consumer facing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the follow up to that is, like, I feel like the brands are also trying to figure out, how do we make this, how do we make a takedown of this? How do we bring this into a consumer level that's at the, you know, let's say $100, $150 range versus the $200 to $300 range?
Yeah.
And how do you view all of that as, you know, someone who's maybe deeper into the performance side of it, I guess?
Sure. I mean, I think it's all tied up with the huge increase in runners over the past 5 years. I think there are some estimates that say there are 50% more runners now than there were 5 years ago, you know, pre-pandemic. So that's in terms of, you know, the potential for making money, which is how all the brands are thinking about it. Oh, there's 50% more people. We can up revenue by 50% just by selling more units. Simple as that. But then if on top of that, they think about who these new runners are, these are people that are in their first 5 years of running. And that is when you have your sharpest increase in, you know, in ability, essentially. So you might start with a 5K, but you can graduate to a decent marathon level within 2 years. You know, you could, let's say, first marathon within 2 years of starting running. You can go harder than that if you feel like you need to. But if once you're 5 years in, you could be on your, you know, 5th, 10th marathon and, like, really aiming to go for it. That's too many marathons, in my opinion, but that's another conversation. But, you know, if you're doing marathon after marathon, trying to increase your time, training and training and training, you're going to want, for all that time you're investing in your training, we're talking 2, 3, 4 hours every weekend morning, plus all the rest of the work. You know, that's just the long run. If you're going to invest all of that time, you also want all the best materials, all the best tools to do your job. And that is the most expensive pair of shoes, right? It's got to be. Yeah. It's got to be. You've got to trust that if you're going to drop $300, then it's going to be the best shoe. And, you know, the evidence suggests that is the case a lot of times. But ultimately, the money is there to be made. So, you know, and there are people willing to pay it. So
do you think that if, I mean, Nike kind of already does this, but, like, let's say, you know, using, like, the Alpha Fly or Vapor Fly, you know, like, there's so many variations. But, like, I think one of the challenges for the brands is figuring out a way to make that high end shoe more accessible, but still look like a high end shoe. Because, you know, there's for every person that, you know, makes it to 2, 3 marathons in that 5 years, there's, you know, twice as many that probably do a handful of 5Ks, a 10K or something like that.
Sure.
And then there's even more that just want the look of that, you know, that style, right? Not, you know, not here to judge, but, like, that feels like a connection that is almost like a new challenge for the brands to figure out, because there's such a movement on the, you know, aesthetic side of running right now too, that layers on top of this, even outside of footwear, right? It's there's so many running brands that are coming up trying to create new interesting ways of, you know, gear and whatnot. Is it possible for the big brands to kind of play in that world without diminishing, you know, like the real, like, yeah, I would say successful, uh-huh, you know, shoes that they've created over the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why not. Like, you know, let's go back to, we're talking about Stan Smith. That's a tennis shoe. We're talking about Jordans. That's a basketball shoe. I think, you know, we've come through, I think it was probably about 25 years ago that my friends were wearing like martial arts shoes as well, mm-hmm, you know, like little, almost like ballet pump kind of things. Ballet pumps. Wearing them around, and then you've got the Gorp Core movement of hiking footwear and stuff like that. So yeah, maybe it's running's turn for that. And I don't think it would be the carbon plated stuff, but if they can, if someone like Satisfy can sell the Rocker, or Norda can sell their shoes for people just walking around, Solomon does it with the XT6, you know. Yeah. That's a trail running shoe. So I think, yes, absolutely. Like, because they're such technical items, they have that look to them that you can fit in with kind of, you know, a bit more of a futuristic sci-fi look, you know, especially with your baggy cargo pants and stuff like that. It's a look. So yeah, I think there's no reason why, I don't think, carbon plated shoes look good in that situation personally, but maybe that's just because I can't pull it off.
Story of my life, man. Story of my life. I think that's a really interesting conversation. Like, I think you could go pretty deep on that, because there is a lot of, you know, and you mentioned like the Gorp Core stuff, and you can kind of see it in what Nike has done with like Acronym and brands like that are very like Japanese inspired.
There's
just so many layers to all of that that have not, they're maybe mainstream, using some air quotes here for listeners, but like mainstream to people that pay attention, but definitely not, you know, the average consumer, not something the average consumer is going to pay attention to, which kind of leads me into my next question about, you know, part of what I think you allude to in the book a little bit. You probably talk about it more in the book as you get into the book, I would imagine, but you alluded to it earlier about just like the accessibility of running, you know, but then like, it's also this very like, you know, $300+ sneakers is not necessarily accessible at the same time.
No.
So
no.
Maybe talk a little bit about that and like how you view that.
Yeah. I mean, $100 sneakers do exist. They do. And, I buy, I made a point of only buying my running shoes on sale. Last season's, get them half price, especially with the big brands like Nike and Adidas. They do amazing sales. So yeah, there are opportunities and potential for us, you know. You know, I've written an essay about, you know, my parents are in Bangladesh. So I got in touch with, this marathoner in Bangladesh and asked him about the economics of running. He basically has to wear his shoes for too long. There's a wisdom that a pair of running shoes lasts between 250, 350 miles, depending on a variety of factors, you know, what you're running on, your weight, etc. And he generally ran on his for 1,000 miles. So
that is, you know, crazy.
It's crazy, but that also leads, because he can't afford it. You know, we're talking about $300, but for him, it's more like, you know, 3-4 times the price. So he might be talking about $600, $700 pair of running shoes, but he loves running. So he sacrifices so much to buy that pair of running shoes. And, but then by wearing it for too long, that can lead to injuries because the cushioning's not there anymore, protecting his joints. So, you know, it's a big problem, in terms of global inequalities there, let alone what we have within the US.
Yeah. I never really think about like how long the, you know, trajectory of wearing a pair of running shoes is.
Yeah, yeah.
Until I find a shoe that I like running in. Yeah. And like this happened, this is 5 or 6 years ago now, but like, I forget which one it was. One of the pre kind of like, what was it? Maybe like the Pegasus Turbo or something like that. That was like one of the first ZoomX runners that Nike did, where it's like, oh, this is interesting because I've played basketball in these shoes. So I know this cushioning very well. And then was running in that so much so that like it was just starting to deteriorate. And like at that time, it was kind of like, wow, like I guess awakening for me too, like, but I never really think about like, you know, there's not, the brands wouldn't want to say there's a timeline on how long these shoes would last, because that's the myth of all of it is like, well, you need it, to your point, you need next seasons. You already need next seasons, you know, like the discounted ones are, that's last year, you know, get to the next ones. So,
I very much don't care about my fashion while I'm running. I like to think that I'm just too fast for anyone to notice. That's not the case. But, you know, they've been talking about that more and more recently. You know, there are some brands that are talking about, you know, the longevity of their shoe. There's like Mountain to Coast, which is talking about how you can put 1,000 miles on a pair of shoes. Yeah. And just on the base economic, you know, value for money thing, if you can buy one pair of shoes that lasts three times as long, amazing.
Yeah.
Running shoes are, for a runner anyway, they're much more about utility. And so they're a tool, and the longer that tool lasts, the better. If we're going back to the conversation about fashion, doesn't matter as much. You can just wear the shoes, and you're unlikely to put 300 miles on a pair of shoes you wear around casually.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think that there's let me think about how, do you think that there's you know, like with these kind of super shoes, the carbon plate technology and all of that, especially kind of going back to the idea of like accessibility and like, you know, someone like, you know, who you mentioned in Bangladesh having to wear it for that amount of time, where like the financials of the shoe is a huge kind of entry point. Is it worth the investment in your perspective to shoot for the moon and say, I'm going to go for this, like, you know, whatever $300 super shoe when, you know, there's probably, to your point, and I, you kind of answered this in the way that you approach it, but I guess what I'm asking is like, how do you view the difference between those shoes at $300 carbon plate technology, the best of the technology that exists, versus, you know, a $120 shoe on sale that doesn't maybe have all those fancy you know, marketing campaigns that get that price up there for the average person?
I think it's one of the things I try to encourage with my newsletter is to think more deeply. And I think it comes down to that. Really think about why you're running. If you're trying to qualify for Boston Marathon, for instance, you need to get a very specific time. And if this pair of shoes knocks off 1%, like allows you to run 1% faster, or the 4% that they, you know, suggest, like 4% is huge. 4% is huge. Like you give me a 4% pay rise, I'll be so happy. You give me a 4% pay cut, I'll be very unhappy. It's significant. So 4%. In that's like, could be it's over five, you know, it's let's say you're trying to do a sub 3 hour marathon, 180 minutes, that's like almost 10 minutes, you know, over 5 minutes certainly. And so it's like, my maths on the spot was not good, but the, you know, that's a lot of time to knock off. And so if that is worth it to you to spend the extra $150, go for it. Like, but you know what your budgets are. You know what you know what those 5 minutes are worth to you on the race day. Because, like I said, runners invest a lot of personal time. This is all leisure time. This isn't a job, you know. Yeah. This is all leisure time. This is a hobby. And so, if you're really going for it and spending your time training, working to get a time to do something for yourself, to prove to yourself that you can do something. Yeah. I think it's perfectly reasonable to spend the extra money if you have it and if it's not going to put you into trouble. But if you're already spending that much time out of the house, you likely don't have a family, or you have a family that doesn't like you very much. One of the two.
So one thing I wanted to circle back to, that kind of that we kind of started the conversation but didn't go too deep into it.
Sure.
I think you kind of, I forget, I'm not going to be able to point to the specific part in the book that you talk about it, because I was flipping through, but you kind of alluded to like finding yourself in running, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's a really interesting rabbit hole to go.
Yeah,
down,
it is.
For lack of a better term, because
it is.
You know, I was recently kind of thinking about how, you know, we're probably close to the same age where we lived in a world where we had boredom.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays we don't have boredom because yes. we're always plugged into a phone or a computer screen or a TV or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you look at that aspect of, like, you know, of running, you know, kind of a deeper purpose behind it.
Yeah.
And what you would suggest for people that are just starting out or mm-hmm. curious about going out for a run,
yeah.
how you approach that, whether that's even down to kind of the mechanics of it.
Oh, you
know, headphones versus no headphones, podcast versus music, like what you experience in that kind of more visceral side of this.
I love this, talking about this stuff. Absolutely no headphones. Don't wear headphones. Like, take it as a moment to unplug, you know. When I started running is because as an adult is because I was a music journalist listening to music every waking hour. And so those minutes running along the river, that was my silence. That was my only time of silence during the day. And yeah, you know, learning about yourself, that's a dangerous one because you might not like who you find at the end of that. You know, running isn't therapy, but it is therapeutic, is what I'll say. And that silence, that boredom, that ability to like sit with yourself and actually, you know, feel who you are in that moment where you're stressing yourself, you can learn a lot about who you are, how you deal with certain situations. I think the possibilities are endless in terms of what you can find out. And I think that's one of the reasons why people like to push themselves, like try and do a marathon, try and do ultra marathons, like really push, find their own limits. I don't personally, I don't want to find out my limits. Very happy just doing my little 5 mile runs. But it's so important. Again, think about why you're running. Think about what you want to achieve. I know that, you know, there are really successful business people, for instance, who run to kind of formulate the resilience inside themselves. And they take those lessons into the boardroom with them, you know, that little bit of grit and determination. They're like, I can run up this hill. I can face down this business transaction next week, kind of thing. You know, it's like, it sounds silly in that context, honestly, but it really is a way of giving yourself confidence that you can do something. And the opposite is true. When you're injured, you kind of lose that ability to, you lose belief in yourself sometimes, I think is also true. So it is a rabbit hole, certainly. Can talk about it forever.
Yeah, it's interesting because I personally have way more vivid dreams when I'm running.
Yeah.
So that's usually motivation. Like, you know,
yeah.
It's an interesting byproduct of it. Mm. You know, I can totally understand the boardroom example.
Sure.
I can understand the silence example. For me, you know, writing is really the silent space where mm-hmm. like, you know, I write online, but I write twice as much just mm-hmm. getting things out of my head and putting them places, you know, like, mm-hmm. let me just make sense of this for myself.
Yeah.
And running kind of almost like feels, you know, like some sort of like level up of that in mm-hmm. a lot of ways because of like how regularly my dreams are much more vivid.
Yeah.
Like I just am like very much aware of that, which is an interesting byproduct that I hadn't really thought of, being that I haven't ran in a couple of years regularly because I've been dealing with some health issues. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting rabbit hole.
There are in terms of the creativity aspect as well, that's something that I've been researching and learning about for the past few years as well, on and off, you know, not intensively, but some of there was a study, let's say 10 years ago, that they found a direct correlation. I think something like they had two test subjects or two groups. One went for a run or a walk and the other one didn't. And then they were both sets were asked to think of things that you can do with an inanimate object. I think it was a brick. What can you do with a brick? Think of ideas to do with this brick. The group that went for that moved their bodies, they came up with 60% more ideas. Like, that's huge. Yeah.
Wow.
That's, yeah. You can't argue with that. And so there are these real links between moving your body and clearing your mind. You know, like, I think we've always known about, I'm going to go for a walk to clear my mind, you know, just like to figure shit out. Yeah. And there's evidence for it.
Yeah.
So,
wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, so I guess like you mentioned, you know, like music in your background.
Yeah.
How does that kind of shape your view or, you know, your experience with running to get to this point? Are you still doing the music, the writing and journalism on the music side, or
just listening?
There's
no real direct links. It's kind of like transferable skills. Still writing, and I write kind of in the same way. One of the things I really like doing the most as a music journalist was interviewing artists, and but rarely about the music, as it was a lot about how and why they wrote the record and how it makes their fans feel. So it's kind of the same shit. I write about running in the same way that I used to write about music. I used to talk about music culturally, like, you know, where a band was from, how they got to where they are. Rather than any, I didn't really enjoy doing the direct judgment of a person's art. You know, it felt quite vulgar in that sense. And in the same way that I don't like to judge a person's speed or marathon time. Like, this doesn't matter to me. It's that's theirs. So yeah, there's that. That's the parallel, I'd say. I write about running in the same way that I used to write about music, which is in a non-judgmental fashion.
Well, and I'm glad you answered it that way, because I was thinking, like, even from the little bit I've been through it, you've clearly done a bunch of interviews for this book to include them in where you know they fit, and knowing now that that's your background, like, definitely gives me a much better understanding of all of that too, because I think, you know, I kind of think the same ways, having that a similar background, you know, like, started even the sneaker thing with, you know, print magazines way back in the day. And it's really interesting to see those, you know, like you said, transferable skills, right? Because like, it gives you a good way to frame a new experience.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's really just life, you know, like we have these new experiences and then we're like representing it to our audience or to our, you know, community.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we've all got something new to be excited about. So, I guess like that's kind of the last question I had for you, but I do think, like, you know, for people that are listening, how, you know, we'll put the link in the description for the book, but definitely want to give people a way to connect with you outside of the book itself.
Yeah.
This is running, so it's available, you know, pre-order, or it will be available this week or next week, I believe, by the time this goes up.
It's Thursday today, so it's out in the UK in 1 week's time, and in the US the following Tuesday, so like 11 days, something like that, 12 days. So that's fun, not at all scary at all, sure. I'm on Substack. Running Sucks is the name of the newsletter. and on Instagram, runningsucks101. Come say hi and buy my book. Cool. Buy my book.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good one. I mean, I think you nailed it with the description at the beginning. It's definitely something that you can have just out and be able to kind of bring people into different aspects of running. Yeah. And then they can find the parts that they're not paying attention to that they didn't know even existed, which is really cool.
I wanted it to be a beautiful artifact, because even if you don't like reading, which is a lot of people, you can still, you know, you can still be a poser and just have it on your coffee table.
yep. definitely. Well, I appreciate you making the time and coming on the show and letting people know. And great conversation.
Yeah.
Book is awesome. I'm pretty stoked to see how it goes for you, and definitely going to keep in touch.
Thanks a lot, Nick. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks for listening. If you've made it this far.
Yeah. If you made it this far, leave us a review and let us know that you made it this far.
Oh, yeah. Five stars. It's got to be a 5 stars.
All right. We appreciate everybody. Thanks for listening, rocking with us. We'll catch you in the next one. Peace.
Hey, Nick here again. Before you take off, I want to thank you for listening to the Sneaker History Podcast. If you want more insights into the sneaker world, I've started a newsletter called the Sneaker Newsletter to share my knowledge of over 2 decades experience working in the footwear industry. You can find the link below or go to thesneakernewsletter.com. Last but not least, tell someone you like their kicks today. You never know how far a simple compliment can take you, and we all know how good it feels to be on the receiving end of some appreciation. Thank you for all the support, and we will catch you on the next episode. Peace.